Part 1. Boys. They were young and did not leave much behind them and need someone to remember them. Norman Maclean, Young Men and Fire, 1992. 1. The climbers went to bed early and rose in the dark to stuff ropes and pitons, stove and sleeping bags, tea and scraps of food into their tattered rucksacks. They struggled into boots and crampons and emerged from the relative warmth of the alpine hut to cross the glacier under a sky pocked with stars. The mountains looked to young Chris Bonington like black velvet cutouts against the starlit sky. Chris and his companion, Hamish McInnes, shivered as they walked with their burdens. They were silent for the most part. They saw the route, the southeast spur of the Point de l'Épigny, a series of overhangs. It looked impossible to Chris. He reminded himself that he was becoming a seasoned alpinist. At 23, he'd been climbing for 7 years. This season, the summer of 1958, was his second in the French Alps. He was a superb natural climber, and he was ambitious. He didn't look it, though. He looked young, even soft. He was a gangly, brown-haired boy. He had a long face with high cheekbones, full lips and smallish blue eyes. He had a baby's complexion. He was a graduate of the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. He commanded a British tank troop stationed in Germany. Still, those overhangs looked hideous. Hamish was older. He was 27, just back from his second Himalayan expedition. He didn't seem worried about the overhangs, but then that was the problem with Hamish. He never worried about anything. He was a lean-faced fellow with hollow cheeks and deep-set eyes, an eccentric who insisted on eating brown bread and who slept on the floor for his health. He had an interest in mountain rescue, but he was himself horribly accident-prone. He'd fractured his skull falling from a climb the previous summer. That same evening he'd gotten drunk and tried to climb a church. He'd fallen again, breaking a leg. The two climbers roped up and moved across the easy terrain at the bottom of their route. There was something spectacular about these first moments of a day in the mountains. You began walking with a sour stomach, your body cold and stiff. Soon you would start to sweat and wake up. The difficulties lay well ahead, and now you were keenly alert to the beauty of this place, of your surroundings. You pitied the people who slept in the valley. Chris was afraid of what might happen, and yet pleased with how things had turned out. He felt as though his story had come to its happy conclusion, and all the while he knew that the range of the day's possible outcomes included his own death, a death that he understood vaguely as emerging with the inky shapes of mountains, discernible in this earliest morning only because their forms blotted out the stars. They entered a gully next to the face. It let them bypass the worst overhangs. Chris thought they should simply follow the gully to the summit. Hamish brushed this notion aside and led back out onto smooth rock slabs, which required slow and painstaking work. They climbed until it was nearly dark and spent the night on a ledge under an overhang. Chris tucked himself into a nook in the rock. He had brought a sleeping bag and he wrapped it in plastic sheeting, but he was too cold to sleep. He was eager to move in the morning, and he led the first pitch. He tied one end of the rope to his waist and began to climb. As he moved higher, he looked for cracks in the rock or other spots where he could place protection, mostly metal pitons or wooden wedges. He hung a sling from each new piece of gear and clipped a carabiner, a gated metal oval, to the sling. That done, he clipped his trailing rope to the carabiner. The rope now ran from Chris down through each protection point all the way to Hamish at the start of the pitch. Hamish had passed the rope around his waist. He fed out slack as Chris moved higher. He would hold the rope if Chris fell. The length of the fall would depend upon how far Chris had climbed past his most recent protection. Assuming his gear held, he would fall roughly twice that distance. The climbing here was difficult. Chris was forced to resort to artificial techniques. He tied long slings to wedges and stood on the slings to gain height. That's what he was doing when one of the wedges came out. He hurtled through sky, utterly disoriented, and then stopped. He was intensely relieved. His lower wedge had held, but dimly aware of a mindless, a physical disappointment, as if his body had wished to keep falling. He dangled up